Hoe zorg jij voor transformatie in jouw organisatie?
Hoe kom je in beweging? Hou je koers of stuur je bij? Duw je door of zet je een stap terug?
Hoe houd je de bezieling, de energie?
En wanneer is het tijd om te stoppen met veranderen?
In Verandergasten vragen we het aan mensen die verandering vormgeven.
Leer van hen hoe zij hebben geworsteld, hebben gefaald en hebben overwonnen.
Dit is de podcast van Sede de Boer over het realiseren van transformaties.
The societal challenges in our days are numerous, from gender equality to food security and sustainability. These challenges are not simple A to B changes. It concerns a vast number of stakeholders, different views, and the need for system change. And it is these changes that are the playground of our guest in this international version of Verandergasten. Marion Goodman is a senior faculty member of the Presencing Institute. This institute spreads the knowledge and skills to use Theory U in necessary societal change. With what mindset does Marion Goodman start a new change process? And what does she do when it gets tough? My name is Glenn van den Burg and Marion Goodman is our Verandergast. Great to have you on the show, Marion, all the way from South Africa. I think my favorite country, but we already discussed that before we started recording. Throughout this interview, Theory U will probably play an important role. Can you explain in short what it is?
Yeah, in short is the hard question.
I can imagine, yeah.
Thank you, Glenn, for having me here today. Sometimes when I'm trying to explain what is Theory U, I will say it's a way of being in the world. So it's a language. It's a way of naming some of the things that are deeper inside systems, some of the more hard to frame or access elements that are the underlying dynamics in a system that cause things to show up the way they are. It's also, there's a movement actually of Theory U that's happening throughout the globe in all corners of people wanting to bring about change. So change agents in companies, in grassroots communities, in indigenous communities all over. And so Theory U, in my view, is not a theory. Perhaps it's a badly named, I don't know. But
because it's a theory suggests that it is a set of things, and if you put them together, something will happen.
Yeah, well, it is that. And the set of things is a framework, a methodology, and tools and practices that if you apply them, there's a high possibility you're going to be able to access some of the deeper roots of transformation, of deeper transformation, but also sustainable change. And if you don't get at those deeper roots, I think you risk having very superficial change that's probably not going to last.
Yeah. And what we're used to is to, if there's a problem, we analyze the problem, we start thinking about solutions, and we start solving. So that's kind of a linear way of thinking about change, which sometimes works when it's not that complicated. But Theory U also starts with what's going on, but then with the U, which you also can imagine here in your mind, you start delving down to another point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So take us on that journey through the U.
I will. And the one thing I must say is that Theory U is part of an emerging field of study and research called awareness-based systems change. So recognizing that whatever the consciousness is in a system, where it's operating from, the operating system level, if you like, is going to determine what that system looks like, but also determine where you can intervene in order to bring about changes. And those levels relate to the intelligences of the mind, the intellect, the beauty and the brilliance of our capacity to think. But it also relates to the intelligence of the heart and our ability to feel and to feel into others, but also context. And then there's the intelligence of the body or the physical will, if you like, which helps us to act, to do something, even when we don't know what it is we're supposed to do. So the journey or the pathway, if you like, that we encourage when we are using Theory U says, for the complexity of the problems that we're dealing with, like you say, if it's a straightforward problem with a straightforward answer, then Bob's your uncle, as they say in English. Just do it. But if it's complex or it's involving many stakeholders or many different interests or multiple ranges of issue that are interconnected, then what we've found is you can't just rely on a model or a training that you might have had, even your beautiful executive MBA that told you how you were going to lead, etc. Because stuff is changing so fast that all the things we got taught, even if it was last year, they're a little bit not quite the tools we need, because they're based on past understanding, past knowledge, things that worked in the past but don't work now. So we suggest putting that aside for a moment.
Uh-huh.
So suspend that for a moment, your instant solution expert advice.
Yeah, because it's also a tendency that we have to think, oh, if this, then we should.
Yeah.
And one of the things in Theory U is that not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
No.
Suspend your problem-solving skills.
Exactly. Suspend that so that you can give yourself a chance to start to feel into what's really going on in the whole system. And not just your part of the system that you can see or that you function in daily, but right out to the edges of the system, to the margins. And in a complex social system, for example, to the people who are right on the edges, factor all of that in. What's the current reality in that situation, so that when you do eventually work your way towards finding solutions or experimenting with different changes, you're taking into account the whole system and not just the interests of a few, which is what's got us into so many problems before.
Mm.
So we call that first phase or movement, we call it observing deeply, sensing into the whole system with fresh eyes, fresh ears, listen new, see new, be surprised, so that you're taking more of reality into account as you're working towards your solution. But then that's just the first step. The next step is, although the temptation will be there to jump quickly from A to B, that your solution is now clear because now you know what the system's doing, you actually need to take one step back first. So just insert some kind of a pause, a moment of letting go of everything that you've heard or seen, in order to connect with your own deeper intuition. We call it connecting with your own deeper sources of wisdom, but it's also connecting with the deeper motivation, the deeper drivers. Like, why does this matter? Why would you even want to do something about it? Who cares? And once you've been able to activate that sort of will to do something, then you can start moving to the, and we call that second phase, we call it retreat and reflect. Just pause for a moment.
Yeah.
And then there's the third movement or third phase, which we'll call act in an instance, where you move into rapid cycle experimental action. So don't try to make a whole 10-year project plan with a big budget and a whole project manager and so on. It's like literally start hacking the system.
Yeah, trying things out, prototyping.
Prototyping, yeah. Guerrilla tactics, learn by doing. So if you do it like this, the system gives you feedback in that so you can adjust quickly and adapt until you start to begin to shift the direction of travel.
Yeah.
And that's Theory U.
Wow.
It's as simple as... simple and as complicated as that.
Yeah, and there are already 100,000 things within that that I'm thinking, yeah, it's easy to say
suspend your problem solving or suspend your the ideas that you have or no, suspend anything that you are thinking. That's so complicated.
Yeah.
But we'll dive into that, how you are doing that. So, like with everyone else, first we start with...
Verandergasten.
Beginnen met veranderen.
All right. So, Marion, let's say you start a new change program or how you will call it. I don't know what the normal phrase is that you you use. Something like
project,
that.
Transformation project.
Yeah.
Yeah, initiative.
How do you make sure that you yourself have the right mindset for starting such a thing?
That's a great question. Because, and this is what I'm coming to see more and more clearly as I get more experience and gain more years, is I start with not knowing anything. So the strongest starting point that I've found is a place of internal stillness. Drop the noise, the clutter, the am I going to do this right? Do I know what's going to happen? What will the client think of me, etc.? Drop the noise, open up the space inside myself so that my interior state, if you like, is the most receptive possible and the most sensitive to be able to pick up cues that might be quite subtle. Mm. That maybe what people are saying or maybe what I'm seeing on the edges of the system. And if I'm too busy with my pre-set trajectory of this is what's got to happen and this is how I do it and I always do three of these and four of those and one of these, then I don't have the space to be able to pick up on the cues. And the risk then is falling into the trap of old solutions or let me just grab hold of something because I'm supposed to be an expert of change management here, right? So that's a very deliberate state of being.
How do you do that? Because on the one hand, you say, well, with the years comes the wisdom that I should try to be as open and not grasping all the knowledge that I have and to use it, but just... know nothing, be as blank as possible. And also I hear you say, well, it's also my own thoughts about, can I do this? How will they think of me? So that's more of a personal thing. How do you get into a state of being so, well, of tranquility, of being a magnet for everything that happens in your surroundings?
It's a wonderful question, Glenn. And in different spaces, I've heard a similar phrase of get yourself out the way, right? So that's one thing. It's like you matter and you don't matter at all. You're everything and you're absolutely nothing. And if... that's quite a relaxing feeling. Like I don't carry everything here on my shoulders. There is a wisdom in the system. It may be deeply latent. It may be sort of untapped as a potential, but the system knows what direction it wants to evolve in.
Mm-hmm. It's already there.
It already exists and it may just need midwifing. It may just need the right conditions to be able to come through. So the question that sits with me, I suppose, in that space of letting go of my own ambitions, perhaps, or the pressures that are coming, that this thing is urgent and has to be solved right now, is the question of what am I in service of here? So what's my value? And who or what do I serve? And obviously that relates to, you know, for each one of us, our own sort of bigger sense of what's our purpose and why we're here and what's our contribution. But it's also
the combination of things that seem to be impossible to
be both there. So being very responsible and also knowing that you're just you as one person. Taking the lead, but also knowing that you cannot change that much yourself, which seem to be some two things that are not, they're not able to be there at the same time.
I think they are, though. It's this strange sort of paradox or dichotomy that we can live in. It's uncomfortable because it's a paradox, but you can actually sit in the middle of it and relax. I think with it also comes a deep trust in life that actually the system knows. The system knows. And if you look at nature, if you look at how things grow or change in where there isn't a lot of human intervention or interference, there's a wisdom there. There are patterns. They get on with it. So it's a little bit similar in my view with social systems, that you can watch what are the patterns, what are the messages, what's going on here, and then take your cue from that to look at where are the openings for that potential to come through. So sometimes we say, where's the crack where the light, you know, light comes
Leonard
in.
Leonard Cohen, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, beautiful.
And if you're too busy with the pressures that are going on inside your head or outside of you, if you're too preoccupied with that, you don't notice those cracks.
And the funny thing is that you're using other language, other words, when you're talking about change, because if you do it in a more, let's say, powerful way, you say, well, we have to change the system, we have to steer it in the right direction, we have to make sure everything starts moving again, then you have the feeling that there's a lot of work to do. And then when I'm listening to you, I get the vision of, oh, this system that we're talking about, this society or maybe a community in within a village or a town, there's already a lot of movement and already a lot of energy. And maybe the only thing you have to do is to take something away, like a barrier, or help people talk to each other. But it's a whole different way of looking at your task or your role in the change than saying, yeah, well, no, we have to get things moving. We have to roll something out, or all the other language that I usually hear when I'm talking to people that are changing things within organizations.
It is different. I will always start with, what is the intention here? And is that intention clearly held and understood by everyone? Is there an alignment at the level of intention? Like, why are we even doing or considering doing whatever it might be? And that's a crucial step of clarifying. So what are we really trying to bring about? What really matters the most to people? What is the world or the community that they want to leave for their as yet unborn grandchildren? So it's like it's getting to the deepest driver, if you like, the deepest motivation level, where somehow we can connect, even if we have different interpretations or different ways of saying it. But somehow, yeah, if we could get that moving, we're on a good direction. If we don't do that, or if we only take the direction of maybe someone in the highest position of authority or decision making, and we're trying to execute on the system their will of what ought to happen. And it happens in companies, corporations all over. You know, you develop a beautiful vision and mission statement and values, and then you'll roll it out. But really?
Yeah. Yeah. And who's underneath that thing that you're rolling out?
And how sustainable is that if you haven't, I sometimes call it, activated the deeper will, the deeper sense of, this connects to what I truly believe matters. That's where you get sustainability. Then it's almost self self-rolling in awareness-based systems change, which I mentioned earlier. We use the very common metaphor of the iceberg and the framing of the iceberg, where 10% is what we see, and that's just what's above the waterline, but actually all the underlying causative elements are below, or 90% below the water. So we have to get at that, those underlying things, and they relate to what kind of structures we've, what rules, what regulations, what systems, operations, etc. But even deeper than that are the mindsets, the value systems that give rise to the structures. So if you just do structural change, yeah, you might, in certain situations, it might be quite exactly what you need. But if you don't attend to what are the driving paradigms of thought, the value systems, the worldviews, the beliefs, those structures are going to be tentative, right?
Yeah.
So there's this need to make sure there's coherence in the change process between the structures, the thoughts that drive them. But in awareness-based systems change, we look even deeper than that at what we sort of broadly package in the word source. And you could say the source of our creativity, the source of our identity, the source of our deeper motivation and inspiration. And if you can get at that, and quicken that, activate it, connect with it, then all the thinking patterns, the structures, and eventually what becomes visible above the surface is that much stronger and more sustainable, because you've connected with the deeper drivers, deepest drivers. So in a process of transformation or an initiative that's trying to bring about change, my attention will always be on all those levels. And also looking at where is the attention of the system currently? Has it got fixated or stuck maybe on one or other thing? Like, we're all only about what are our procedures here? Mm. And, you know, do we have the right percentage of X kind of people in the system?
We have a very interesting discussion in the Netherlands about, what is it? Nitrogen?
Yes.
And the discussion now is, should all the goals have been met in 2030 or 2035? That's where the discussion is about.
Yeah.
But that's not what it's about. It's about a very, very deeper layer that is, of course, about our environment, about nature, about what we want to pass through to our unborn grandchildren.
Yeah.
And nobody's talking about that anymore.
Yeah.
It's just about a year.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand it. It's like the mind, if you like, grabs onto the nearest thing that you can grab, because the other stuff is so ephemeral and so subtle, and, you know, it's hard.
And sometimes vague also.
Exactly.
Yeah, you probably get that a lot.
Yeah.
Wow, what is this?
Yeah.
We have to change the world. We don't have time for all this vague stuff.
Yeah. I think, you know, I've grown up on the African continent, and been, to whatever degree, quite deeply exposed to the more land-based way of approaching things, which has a different rhythm and a different point of entry and a different process than what I've come to recognize in all my work and travels and so on in Europe, North America, you know, the North, the West. Where the mind is like an insatiable beast, if you like, which requires the certainty of the things that it can hold, name and hold. And then that gives a kind of a foundation underfoot, and so then you can move on that foundation. But the loss is this whole range of intelligence, innate intelligence that we all possess, but we've kind of got separated from it. So Descartes wasn't helpful.
Yeah, I think and therefore I am.
Exactly.
Yeah. I feel and therefore I am, it should be.
Exactly.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's something that's that I've come to appreciate. It's also shown up in my work in Latin America. This connectedness, a kind of a coherence between mind, heart, and body, and obviously different in different places. But recognizing that the human being has multiple intelligences that really can and need to all come into play if we're to find our way into solutions that solve, rather than really good ideas that we can throw a lot of resource and a lot of clout and a lot of political will behind, and then we land up in the world that we've got, which is polycrisis. Nobody had really bad intentions to try to bring us to this point. It is just this profound fragmentation of human and planet, human and other, human and ourselves even. These sort of gross disconnectednesses. And part of what Theory U is seeking to remember or bring back is to bring back a sense of right connection of us with nature, of us with we say Mother Nature as if we're not nature, but we are. So this sense of I am nature, I am you, that's in the African continent, we'll call that Ubuntu, that I am because you are. As myself, I am nothing, but we coexist. Our existence is predicated on our awareness of our interconnectedness. And then, of course, this internal reconnection of ourselves with our sense of hope, our sense of purpose. You know, all the issues of mental health that are happening in the world all over right now, I feel are so deeply born out of the strongest fragmentation and disconnection. So Theory U is really about inviting or enabling the connectednesses to reconnect so that we can start being useful.
And also embracing the fact that things are complex.
Yeah.
And there are different views and there are different feelings instead of the quick fix. I also have a metaphor for you. We ask all our guests on the show the same thing.
Welk instrument ben jij?
Yeah, maybe your Afrikaans is still enough to understand. So imagine a big orchestra, depends on what kind of music you like, or maybe a band. So if you look at yourself as an instrument of change, what instrument will you be?
An improvising saxophone.
Oh, saxophone. All right.
I don't know where that one came from, but that's what came out.
But now that's, of course, my next question. Why this instrument? Why a saxophone?
To me, the saxophone sounds best when it's surrounded by other instruments, key instruments. Might be a double bass, it might be a keyboard, it might be a percussion of some sort. And the improvising part, I find in the context of music, the ability to listen both to your fellow musicians, to yourself, and to the music that's wanting to emerge is the most phenomenal thing. I mean, yes, there are brilliant concertos.
Sounds like change, yeah?
It really does. But there are, you know, the people who composed things and all of that, extraordinary works. But there's something about, with jazz improv, it's happening in the here and now. It's right now. Nobody knows quite what it's going to be. You might have an idea what sort of key you're in or whatever, but nobody knows quite what it's going to be, but you're in service of that. You're a vehicle for it. So the saxophone then is a vehicle for the music that wants to come through. That's perhaps.
And is that also your place in a
in a change project that you're in the band and you're listening to what's happening and you're in touch with everybody, and then you'll come up with something that's needed at that moment.
Either I'll come up with it or someone else will come up with it.
Okay.
I see more and more the power that's resident in the collective. That, you know, my capability, my intellectual awareness, even what I pick up as cues or perceptions, it's limited. You know, that's just me, and it's got to go through all my conditioning and all my interpretation and all the stuff. But there's wisdom in the collective. And so the art of facilitation, it comes back to that thing that you are really important, you really matter, and you don't matter at all. So, and you know, the greatest intelligence might pop up from the most surprising spot in the room or in the system. It might come from a voice that's not normally given attention to, but that holds the next little unlocking.
Is that a talent of yours to to see that, to give space to that unheard voice that is somewhere in the back of the room and that will normally never speak?
I don't know about a talent. It's certainly a sensitivity. I'm excruciatingly uncomfortable with the margins that get disregarded. There's a long story behind that, my own personal family origin history, but also growing up in apartheid South Africa. So I'm always aware of who's not validated in a room. And very suspicious even of who's holding the power and determining the direction, and how much are they taking into account the whole system, the ecosystem, if you like.
And why is it that it's something that's, I mean, it's in your past. What made you value that, see that, know that it's something that's really important?
So I feel very deeply around justice and dignity of all. And obviously now all the buzzwords of inclusion and, you know, that's become kind of into the main attention. I feel that it's just part of what I notice. I mean, I could go all the way back. My mother was a refugee of Nazi Germany. Her story was one of becoming increasingly invisible as a human being during the years leading up to the war and so on. The systemic dehumanization that occurred in that context, she escaped along with her direct family, but the others didn't. And as we were growing up, she didn't tell her story a lot, at all. But we, as children, grew up with an awareness of that. So it kind of got into our bloodstream, if you like.
It must be strange then, also for your mother to grow up in a country that has apartheid.
Exactly. That's the profound irony of it. So so it also shows, though, how the tables turned so quickly. You, from one moment, you're in the oppressed seats, and then suddenly you're in the oppressing seats, and then it'll turn again. But I think that sort of injection into my bloodstream from a very young age drove me around what's fair and what's not fair. I mean, I remember that as a child, like going, "What? This is not fair." And it could have been minor things, but so I've always, all my work has been about justice, social justice, environmental justice, and sort of putting the balances in back in a different way.
Wow. Somewhere in the change process that you are in, you have to make decisions about when do we go to the next phase. So that's one of the next things that I would like to talk to you about.
Verander gasten.
Doorgaan met veranderen.
Yeah, maybe the most interesting part is when is it enough? When do you feel, sense, together with the group that you're working with? Because, I mean, you've been talking about theory and explaining how it sort of works or can work. Let's put it that way. You have there are these phases that you have to say, okay, and now this the sensing phase is enough, and now we have to go down to the next phase. When do you know that it's time?
So I'll try and answer that with an actual applied example, perhaps. I'm working for a number of years in a large financial institution on the African continent. Very powerful institution, deals with a lot of money, and the desire there is to shift the way the leaders work from a what we call an ecosystem perspective to an ecosystem perspective. And so we call our Theory U program System Mastery. And it's basically a journey through the U that's undertaken over about 9 months or so, with a beginning part that has people going out of their, in this instance, high-rise, 18th floors, building with the Ferraris in the underneath parking and so on, and really going out into society to places and spaces where people are experiencing or doing things differently or solving things from completely different innovative ways. Mm-hmm. And so we'll dive right in and deep and sort of viscerally. So it's a felt and
sensed. Yeah, you can feel it, you can smell it.
Because you're right in it. And then we'll come back to try to make sense of it. So what have we seen or felt or heard out there that in any way relates to how we lead a financial institution? So that will have a time of it. But then there's a time to, okay, so right, we've kind of gathered enough intel, the intelligence. It's sort of sufficient for now. Let's take a step back, because there's that second movement moment. And let's explore. Let's go internal a little bit. Let's reflect. Let's connect with, why are we bankers? It's like,
that's a good question.
What's our role and relevance in the future of society?
Yeah.
And really, the question that somebody asked me the other day was, if you had 20% more courage, what would you do? And so this moment with the bankers is about activating the courage to step out of the box.
Yeah.
That's a kind of a critical transition moment, and in answer to your question, because what happens is people go, oh, great, let's do this. But the fear of actually doing something also kicks in, because it's risky. You know, you're going to step outside the norm.
Yeah.
You're going to start thinking differently. You're going to start initiating things that other people may not like, etc.
Yeah, and they will start thinking things like, well, what happened to you?
Yeah, or what are you doing with my money?
yeah.
So this moment of transition needs to be carefully managed, because the tendency is either you start analyzing it and go, okay, well, if we do that, then we'll get that, so we shouldn't do this, and then and you'll just get stuck in analysis paralysis, right? Or you'll just go mindless and just do anything. So the facilitation of that part, in terms of timing, in terms of just the right degree of nudge to move it forward. So there's a willingness to take the risk. There's a willingness to experiment, but it's not so extreme and so public, in the public eye, that it's kind of under the radar. So you can experiment and explore and sort of try stuff and improvise and so on.
And I can also imagine it just takes time to sink in.
Yeah.
Because when you are thinking about, again, why am I a banker and what's my role in society, you could have all these thoughts, and I think it needs time to get the sharp edges off of it, to think, because I can also think, if you start thinking about it, you're thinking, I shouldn't be a banker.
Yeah.
And you start making rash decisions in your head, and what am I doing with my life? And I'm going to start a B&B somewhere far away. And so it probably also needs time to, going from 0 to 100 and back again to, somewhere in the middle where it's okay.
There's that, and there's also developing the practice of awareness. Come back to that, which you could say is a kind of a mindfulness, which is now buzzword all over the world.
Yeah.
But there's something to it. It's the practices that keep you connected, and keep you connected also to that kind of settledness or stillness that we touched on earlier on in this call, in this conversation, that sort of give you your own internal foundation to take the next step. Sometimes we call it action confidence, that you can actually take one more step, because your foundation is solid. I know I'm bouncing around all over the place a little bit in answer to your question.
No worries. But I'm still curious about, how do you sense as a facilitator of that process that it's enough, that it's time, it's time to move on? What are the things that you are looking at? And maybe it's too much of a feeling more than something that you can really see or touch or hear.
I think, a very, very simple rule of thumb is when things seem to have got stuck, so they're kind of going round and round, or they've got in a groove, like in the old days with vinyl records, when the record needle kind of keeps going around on the same thing. When you notice that's starting to happen, it becomes very evident that something needs to shift.
Okay.
Or something wants to shift. That's one thing that I look for, is, are we going round and round and round now in the same conversation, in the same reasons why we can't do what we should do or whatever it is? And the other one is when there's a kind of a frustration that starts to show up in the system. Frustration, for me, I really like frustration.
I
do, because it's a signal. It's an indicator that something's trying to change.
It's energy.
Yeah. And so if you can notice where in the system are the sources of frustration, you can lean towards those for what they're trying to flip into. So in a change process, when the frustrations start to happen, that's great. That's fabulous information. That's indicating that something wants to shift. So great, let's shift it. And frustration shows up in many different ways, usually through a person or something. But that person, when you're looking systemically, individuals are the voices of the system. So it isn't so much about that person and their particular situation. It's really that person as a voice of the system that's trying to say something to you. Can you listen and then act?
And how do you know if it's the voice of the system or it's an odd voice, somebody that's not the mainstream voice, but it's some other frustration, a personal frustration, or
it's still in the system. Make the circle bigger.
Yeah.
You know, some of my most challenging times as a facilitator of a group process, for example, has been when that odd voice, that maverick or outlier, starts to become louder or more vocal, where the tendency would be shut it out, close it down, get rid of it.
Yeah, because it's annoying.
It's annoying. Yeah. It's uncomfortable. It's not part of the program, right? We didn't agree that it was going to do this. For me, as a facilitator, that's my moment to really get bigger. And the phrase
bigger in the sense of?
In the sense of how much more can I hold, or can I ensure that there's a holding space that can incorporate this element that seems to be outside?
Because then that element that is easily pushed outside needs your help.
It needs to find its belonging. It needs to find its place.
Yeah. And but it also needs somebody, in this case you, as a facilitator, to say, okay, I can imagine that you are irritated or annoyed, rest of the group, but let's go back again to not knowing. Let's hear what's behind this.
Yeah. What's going on? What's actually happening right now? What do we need to hear? What do we need to take into account? Very often, when it's rightly done, when the space is made big enough that this thing doesn't have to feel like it's got to shout its way in, this element, it settles. It settles. It sort of goes, okay, well, yeah.
Gets lost.
Yeah. And sometimes it's the thing that shifts the entire process. So I'll give you another little example. I was working in Brazil in a project it was called Changing the Narrative of Masculine and Feminine for the 21st Century. It was a group of about 45 leaders, but vastly diverse from every spectrum of color, gender, orientation, class, part of society. I mean, it was just the most diverse group. At a certain point, somebody was talking about transgender people. It was an expert psychologist talking about transgender people, and there was a consideration about gender and the future of gender. Someone at the back of the room stormed out the room, and a few others followed to go and see what was going on. Eventually, the person was brought back. There was a break, and then we made a space for this person to speak after the break. It wasn't part of the agenda, but it needed to happen. The person was a transgender male person who had taken great offense to the expert, the psychologist, talking about transgender people when he wasn't one himself. And the person who took great offense at being objectified in the name of expertise.
And talked about.
So we made a space for him to talk about himself, to bring his story in, which led to somebody else bringing their story in, and which changed the DNA of that group forever. We then continued through our U journey process. We went into profound spaces that nobody had ever experienced before, through dialogue and through silence. And in the forests of Brazil with the indigenous tribe that looks after that forest that we went to. So, and then we came out and said, okay, well, what do we need to do? We have had an experience here around what's normally called diversity. We'll call it plurality. Mm-hmm. That's recalibrated us, every single person in that room. But if we hadn't paid attention to the person who stormed out of the room and brought it back to be included, to give it place, the whole collective would have been shortchanged. We would have had an experience, but we wouldn't have had that experience. So the catalyst then can be the outlier, obviously, if the conditions are created for that.
And I also think the wisdom is in the fact that if the change would be something that everybody, I mean, if it was a mainstream thing, there wouldn't be a problem. Maybe it would be difficult, or but then there wouldn't be this big problem. So I always think when I'm working with groups that, especially the odd voices, the outliers, they come with wisdom that could really help shake up the system, shake up the group,
yeah.
And come with with a voice that's normally also that's more if when it's. When it's understood, more people say, yes,
yes,
that was it.
Yeah.
That was the thing that was lingering in my mind or that I felt in my stomach.
Yeah.
All right, Marianne, it's almost time.
Verander gasten.
Stoppen met veranderen.
When do you feel that it's time for you to step aside? That your role as a facilitator of change is finished?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. The sooner the better. For the simple reason that the job is done. And there's a sense that this can be carried forward by those who've got it. And those being those who have the biggest stake or interest in that system, whatever mm-hmm. it is, and who actually own it. I don't own it. I come in as an accompanist or a midwife, and then once the birth is done, you know, made sure that there's the conditions for a good continued growth of this new form or new being, then I can step away.
Mm.
I think there's a lot here around losing ego attachment to your work. So we all like to be needed, right? It just makes us feel, you know, that then we're worthwhile as a human being and so on. And sometimes you get a little bit addicted to that kind of feedback coming, you know, you're so valuable, we can't do this without you, and aren't you great, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That's dangerous territory. And so, again, I come back to you matter very, very deeply and you matter not at all. So when the moment comes that the group or the organization or the collective feels and knows enough confidence to continue, you can just disappear. And I've always sort of felt that if I could disappear and someday somebody will turn around and go, well, there's somebody here, you know, at some point that was, you know, by the name of, then the work has really been done well. Because the sense of ownership, the sense of autonomy and agency is really embedded well in those who continue going on to do it. So, yeah, I do think it's a little bit like I often say in my coaching with CEOs, for example, that from the day you step into your office for the first time, you should be planning your redundancy. So everything you should do, you do, should be with an eye on who's going to take this over from me. And how am I grooming them to do that as best and as fast as possible, rather than how can I get tenure in the seat for the next 20 years?
Yeah, and the funny thing is that almost everybody I asked the question, what do you do when your role in the change is over? How do you mark that moment that you are, handing it over or leaving or whatever word you attached to that, and you just said, well, I just disappeared.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing, but there is also something that I worked with a cultural anthropologist called Dr. Angeles Arian, and She had many very valuable phrases, but the one was noble beginnings and noble closures, and saying that human beings are very good at beginnings, you know, weddings and christenings and, you know, starting things with great joy and fanfare and stuff, but we really suck at endings. And so how can we make our closures and our endings as noble as they could possibly be? And yeah. Sometimes that's an internal job, you know, sometimes that's just I release this situation, this thing, or it might be let's do a little marking of the ritual. Moment in some way, a ritual, a
process. You have an example how you do that?
Well, I remember being involved in a relationship that came to an end, and it was hard, it was not wanted, it was messy, it was grief-filled. And I found myself walking on the mountain nearby my home, and I was just drawn to pull some stones and some sticks and some feathers and things together that were around me and make a little sculpture out of the natural materials. And the sculpture kind of represented that relationship. And then I found myself sort of blessing it in a way, and just sort of recognizing the gifts that it had carried, the gifts that it had given me, how I was not the same person that I was before it happened. So it had left good stuff. And then releasing also in myself some of the harder stuff. And then at the very end, I dismantled the sculpture that I'd created, this beautiful sculpture of wood and leaves and whatever. I dismantled it and let it all go back into the ground. And it was such a release. It was like, it's over. It's done. I can carry on. Mm. So that's a little example.
Wow. Yeah. Beautiful example. Yeah. Yeah. And then in that way, it helps to do something that's tangible.
Yes.
Instead of just talking about it or writing about it, but really having something that you are making and then dissolving it again.
That connects to how profound the wisdom of the body is. And when you do it with your hands or you use your body, there's something else that happens there.
Yeah, there's still a lot to learn about that part within organizations. My final question, I have a million more, but I mean, there is a moment that we have to stop. Final question. I ask this question to everybody in the show. What would you like to share with other change professionals as your final thoughts?
That's an enormous question.
I know.
So there's been something that's guided my whole life, which is a questioning of the rules. So I've always been a rebel. I've always been, if this is a rule, then it's my job to break it. My mother had a saying in German, was, wo steht es geschrieben? So where is it written thus that we should be doing things like this? And it's been such a wonderful releasing mechanism to say, actually, these rules were created by some bright or not bright humans. They can change. In fact, they could change right now. So to be bold, courageous, and brave enough to break rules in the interest of serving the potential of things that's trapped, that's caught under those rules. It's like, it doesn't get better than that, in my view. So take your courage in your hands. Step out. If you knew that you had 20% more courage, what would you do?
What would you do?
And you know what? You're not going to die. So try it anyway.
I think that's also a great question, which I've used for my children also, to say to them, if you have an idea, you want to try something out, first think of the fact, if I do it, is there any chance of me dying? If there is, please consult me. If there isn't, go ahead.
great. Yeah. What a wonderful father.
I try my best. And Phil also. Marion Goodman, it was a real pleasure and a privilege to talk to you. Thank you for being on the show all the way from South Africa. Mm-hmm. We should be recording the next one in South Africa.
Well, your door is open.
Oh, that's great. And jij, you, of course, thanks for listening. Jij bedankt voor het luisteren naar deze aflevering van Verandergasten.
Dank voor het luisteren naar Verandergasten. De podcast van Cede de Boer over het realiseren van transformaties. Je helpt ons enorm met 5 sterren, een like, follow of duimpje. Meer afleveringen vind je in jouw favoriete podcast-app. Vergeet je niet te abonneren als je niks wilt missen.